wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the Land of Oz. In response to the ever-growing supply of business and personal finance shows, from CNBC to CNN FN and CNN Money, to Public Broadcasting's Wall Street Week and Susie Orman specials, we bring you this new series on money, but with a twist. In this series, we'll look beyond the latest Dow and NASDAQ ups and downs and past the hot stock tips of the day and the investment tip of the month, and we'll see just how tricky and undemocratic our monetary system really is.
Investors may decide to take some money off the table after yesterday's decent market run-up. S&P futures down nearly 3 points now, and NASDAQ futures off by 6. Yesterday, the Dow rose 82 points, NASDAQ gained 30 points to close at an 18-month high. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal Report.
Bloomberg Radio is the world's only global radio station. Listen throughout the business day for up-to-the-minute reports from the New York Stock Exchange.
The benchmark stock indexes are lower.
The latest word from the NASDAQ.
Helping lead the NASDAQ lower, Cisco.
Market moves in the Pacific Rim.
The Nikkei average rose for the sixth day in seven.
And breaking news from London.
Markets this side of the Atlantic plunged on the open. And
market reports around the clock from around the globe. Only on Bloomberg Radio.
Stocks are starting out a little stronger than the futures suggested prior to this morning's opening bell. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 33 points to 95.35. The NASDAQ is up 9. The S&P 500 is ahead 3.5. Shares of IBM are up $1.72 or 2%. Big Blue got an upgrade from Credit Suisse First Boston this morning.
The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Minnesota Public Radio in association with the University of Southern California.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 34 points at 10,253. The NASDAQ up 8 points. The S&P is up 4 points. Today, we're in the Emerald City.
The Wizards of Money will take a critical look at the mechanics of today's capital and debt markets. We'll study those who make the critical decisions that drive these markets, and we'll examine how these markets then affect everybody's lives. Humans have inherited a monetary system that fueled the Industrial Revolution, lost its commodity backing during the Vietnam War, and now travels by the trillions in the form of information packets over millions of miles in a matter of nanoseconds. Gold, silver, and physical currency notes are almost irrelevant these days, having been replaced by a system of bits and bytes accounting in electronic networks. While money is simply an abstraction, why it's an invention of the human mind, a mere measure stored in the computers of the banking system, our lives revolve around it, and its disappearance can bring trade to a grinding halt, collapsing whole communities with it. This bizarre situation may be compared to a carpenter stopping work because he's run out of inches, or even a musician calling it quits because he's run out of decibels. Funny, isn't it, how of all the things we wonder about when growing up, like, say, where do babies come from, or why is the sky blue, or how does this or that work, there is one thing that never seems to be addressed. Sure. You can ask grown-ups about money, but all you'll hear is, money doesn't grow on trees. I'm not made of money, you know. Money isn't everything. Money is only useful when you get rid of it. And of course, money is the root of all evil. Well, this is all good advice, but good luck getting an answer about where money really comes from. Well, that's what Wizards of Money is all about. Wizards of Money will discuss the mechanics of money in a way the wide selection of today's financial shows won't. And today, we'll be finding out where money really comes from. In Episode 1, we'll examine how money is made and who makes it. We'll explore the mysterious money-making process by first exploring the origin and the role of one of the most secretive bodies in the world, the Federal Reserve System. We'll also look at the role of the commercial banking system and why it is that the money origination process is not only magical and mysterious, but also quite unfair and undemocratic. In future editions of The Wizards of Money, we'll look further into the workings of the Federal Reserve and its sole shareholders, the private banking industry. We'll also investigate similarly mysterious bodies such as the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, as well as the rapidly growing unregulated parts of the capital markets like hedge funds and the derivatives markets. We'll investigate the wizardry of financial accounting, and we'll look at the role these things play in all of our own lives. Wizards of Money has a website with even more information about the wizards behind the monetary curtain, located at wizardsofmoney.org. And there you can find references and the audio and text of every episode of The Wizards of Money. And for those wanting to wrap their heads around more intricate monetary mysteries, there's even a monetary quiz to test your own wizardry skills. So where does the title, The Wizards of Money, come from? The explanation of this will provide a good historical framework for this series and remind us of a time about 100 years ago when the American citizenry had a much better understanding of their national monetary system and demanded active participation in it. Today, however, for reasons that can only be speculated on, the majority of world citizens have very little understanding of how the international monetary system works. And yet, in this day and age, our lives are largely determined by our relationship to, and we're highly dependent on, the international monetary system. When you live and work amongst something day in, day out, you just sort of take it for granted. So, just like fish surrounded by water, many people seem to have stopped questioning the foundations of the monetary system and go through life largely unaware that these foundations may be on very shaky ground. And additionally, those of us who work in finance have been trained to understand economics and finance in a certain way, often blinding us to new ways of looking at money. Personally, I like to look back on a time when lots of people were questioning all of these things. The name of this series, The Wizards of Money, is derived, of course, from the title of a book written just over 100 years ago called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by journalist L. Frank Baum. Many believe this book to be a social commentary of the times, and one of the most contested issues of the era was the monetary system and whether America should stay on the gold standard or move to a bimetallic standard, meaning that both gold and silver would back money. The gold backing of money would benefit the already rich and powerful financiers of the Northeast who owned most of the gold, such as J.P. Morgan and others. The bimetallic standard would make money more available to farmers and regular workers and was backed by the so-called populist movement of the time.
Oh, every little bit added to what I've got makes just a little bit more. Every time I make a big sum speech, it's $100 at my door.
the people go and turn me down. Still at next election time, I'll be around. Cause every little bit added to what I've got makes just a little bit more.
The monetary system was such a popular public discussion item that talks on this issue drew crowds of tens of thousands from across the country. Interpreters of The Wizard of Oz have suggested the following meanings of characters and places in Oz. Oz, possibly short for gold ounces, may be symbolic of the gold standard of money. The wizardry in Oz may refer to the mysterious money-making process itself. The yellow brick road to Oz may be the way to the grand financiers who supported the gold standard. And I like to think of Emerald City as Wall Street itself, where the wealthy financiers who owned most of the gold were based, and where green glasses, perhaps green for money, were worn. And if you read the book, you'll see that Dorothy's shoes were silver, not red as in the movie, and likely represented the other component of the bimetallic standard. The man operating the wizard possibly represents the financiers behind the presidential candidate at the time who favoured the gold standard, and this candidate was William McKinley. Wizards of Money, as in Oz, is a most appropriate name for those who are responsible for the mysterious money-making process today. In this process, as we'll see, money is essentially created out of thin air. It is only the wizards who get to practice this art, and they do so in the absence of public scrutiny, which might very well ruin their magic. The other main characters of Oz also have counterparts in US society at that time, that is, at the start of the 20th century. You can find some references to these interpretations at wizardsofmoney.org. Well, as it turned out, the populist movement lost, McKinley was elected president, and the gold standard defined the monetary system. But the US still did not have an effective central banking system. So, at the instigation of financiers like J.P. Morgan and his right-hand men, but most of all from the sheer energy and genius of one Mr. Paul M. Warburg, that was all about to change. The birthplace of the Federal Reserve System was not Wall Street or Washington, as people might think. The founders wouldn't dare hold a monetary design meeting in a place where public scrutiny might threaten the magical handiwork of the first wizards. The target destination for the first wizard convention was in a place one generation removed from slavery and with such a remarkable devotion to gold that, less than a century earlier, it had uprooted all of its indigenous inhabitants and marched them off to Oklahoma at the very first smell of gold. What better place could there be to design an undemocratic monetary system based on the gold standard? This state was Georgia, and in 1910 a special wizard convention took place there on Jekyll Island. Duck hunting was the excuse given for the participants having to go there, but numerous historical accounts of this event reveal that the duck population remained fully intact and, instead, the Federal Reserve System was designed. 3 years later, during the week before Christmas 1913, when several representatives were already on vacation, the US Congress slid through the Federal Reserve Act, thereby giving birth to the Federal Reserve System. And today, though the gold standard is no more, we still live with the legacy of that Jekyll Island meeting and some of history's real monetary wizards, particularly that Mr. Warburg. Needless to say, the system they designed had little, well, effectively no, room for public input, and it survived fairly well with the exception of the 1929 crash and subsequent depression, mostly because the general public trusts it. But they do so mostly without understanding it. It is truly a faith-based monetary system, which is a very interesting situation to have in a democracy. And to this day, the mysterious body known as the Federal Reserve is not a government body. In fact, its ownership equity is 100% held by the private banking system. It's one of those strangely partly public, partly private bodies that have so much to do with how the world and its markets run. So how is money created, and what role does the Federal Reserve and its member banks play? Let's start with some common misconceptions about money and why they are not true. Misconception number one is that you make money by going to work or by selling something. This is false because nobody can make money except commercial banks, also called depository institutions, and the Federal Reserve, which is owned by the commercial banking sector. When you get paid for work, it is merely a transfer of money that already exists. It was, at some time in the past, created by the banking industry for a purpose for which they saw fit to create, or really lend, money. The main reason people get a job is to get a transfer of money from people who already have some themselves, so that they can then go out and buy stuff they need and want. When we talk about money here, we mean money that can be used in all transactions and in the repayment of all debts. This is what we're calling bank money. However, many non-bank types of so-called money-raising instruments are increasingly being used by non-bank corporations and individuals to avoid direct contact with the bank money-creating process. This includes things like corporate bonds and shareholder equity, which expand on the bank money supply, but are all completely dependent on and rely on the confidence that they can be liquidated for bank money. So we might call this other stuff near money. However, since in our society it's really bank money that people seem to need for the basics of life, and these other near monies are storage instruments for people that have excess capital, we'll just focus here on bank money in this edition of The Wizards of Money. Misconception number two is that money has something to do with gold and Fort Knox. This is false. The monetary system used to be backed by the gold standard until President Nixon abolished the gold standard in 1971 during the Vietnam War. And he did this because there was not enough gold at Fort Knox in Kentucky to back all the money that needed to be created to fund the massive wartime expenditures. The nixing of the gold standard back in the US dollar led to the floating of most national currencies, which were then no longer pegged to a gold conversion standard. Subsequently, in the post-gold peg era, the world saw phenomenal growth in speculation against international currencies, which has led to massive economic and social crises in various countries whose currencies were speculated against. Examples of this include the Mexican peso crisis of 94-95, the Asian financial crisis of the late 1990s, followed closely by the Russian ruble collapse. Money supply and debt have exploded in the absence of gold convertibility, and it's hard to make sense of what money really means anymore. Money is no longer a store of value. It is merely a measure, an electronic accounting system of credits and debits that has come to be accepted world over as the only way of conducting trade. Furthermore, it's become the primary means of assessing the status of fellow humans. Each day, several trillions of dollars travels around the globe trying to attract more electronic credits for its owners. And now, Real economic transactions involving trade in real goods and services accounts for smaller and smaller proportions of financial transactions, and we truly live in the midst of a global casino. Today's money is not backed by gold. It is now backed by nothing at all except our trust in the monetary system. It is truly a faith-based monetary system. And our trust is ultimately in those that create and control money, the commercial banking system, and the closely related central banks like the Federal Reserve. The statement on all Federal Reserve notes, "In God we trust," is perhaps the most telling statement of this trust. For who would even question something that appears to be so very close to God? Misconception number three is that money is created by the government printing it. This is false because today hardly any money is created by the government. Most of the total money supply is created by banks making loans to the non-bank public. Almost all money is created by the creation of a corresponding amount of debt. Currency notes in circulation are just a very small proportion of the total money supply, and they are created by the Federal Reserve System, not the US Treasury or any other true government body. In truth, money is actually created out of thin air by the commercial banks and the Federal Reserve System. Having gotten some of these misconceptions out of the way, let's talk about the actual mechanics of money creation, which might surprise you. Money creation happens in two main ways. First is the creation of base money, which is mostly physical currency notes created by the Federal Reserve. The second money creation process involves checking account or deposit money created by the commercial banks and which makes up most of the money supply. Base money, also called high-powered money, is created when the Federal Reserve performs what are known as open market operations. In this process, the Federal Reserve injects money by buying government bonds, which then become debt owed by the government, that is, you and I, the American taxpayer, to the Federal Reserve. And where does the Federal Reserve get this money to buy the government securities? Well, it just makes it up out of thin air. The Federal Reserve creates money out of nothing whenever it decides to inject some money into the economy. And almost all money we come by has its basis in high-powered money that the Federal Reserve invented at some time in the past. Most of this base money is currency in the form of Federal Reserve notes. The Federal Reserve then executes an extraordinary piece of accounting wizardry by creating a spurious liability on its balance sheet called Federal Reserve Notes Outstanding, and in return gets an asset in the form of government bonds. Conversely, when the Federal Reserve wants to reduce the base money supply, it sells government bonds and writes off some of this spurious liability, making it vanish just as mysteriously as it was created. Creating new money is equivalent to making money cheaper relative to real goods, and so it's equivalent to lowering interest rates or the price of money. Shrinking the money supply is equivalent to increasing interest rates. Therefore, every time the Federal Reserve creates or extinguishes base money, the financial press and other mainstream media reports it as a Federal Reserve interest rate change. While not technically correct, it does sound rather more palatable than just saying that the Federal Reserve made some money up or made some money disappear. Once this base money is created, banks can create around 10 times this amount in checking accounts and other deposits. They do this by making loans to the non-bank public. A corresponding amount of checking account money is created for each new loan. So most money is created just by bankers writing some new numbers on a piece of paper, or these days entering some new bits and bytes into computers, since money is really now just a bunch of computer records. This means that when you go to borrow money to buy a house or a car, the money is really being created out of thin air by the bank and being credited to the checking account of the seller. The bank would appear to have a distinct advantage in all this, just by being a bank. For if you can't pay the loan through your hard work, they automatically get the house, and all they did was write some numbers into the computer. From the bank's perspective, however, if you don't pay off the loan, they would have to write down their asset, which is your loan, and this would affect the earnings they report. Also, from the perspective of the banking system as a whole, note that the loan, which is an asset of the bank, comes back in as a deposit into the banking system, that is, as an offsetting liability for the banking system. If a certain number of people ran out of money and couldn't pay off their loans, the banks would have to write down a whole lot of their assets. But the banks would still have the same amount of deposits from people who do have money and would be in a position where they couldn't cover these deposits. So you can see why the banking system wants to keep the house if you don't pay off your loan. They are taking a financial risk too, albeit one created completely out of thin air. This money creating process might seem kind of bizarre and out of control, and you might be wondering what sort of checks and balances exist in the system to A, make sure the Federal Reserve doesn't go wild creating so much money relative to the value of goods in the economy that prices keep rising out of control and money becomes worthless, and B, to ensure that the banks don't go crazy making more and more loans so they can keep stuffing new assets onto their balance sheet and new money into the economy. Too much money created in this way could lead to a domino effect where, because some people can't pay off their loans, the parties that lent them the money can't pay off their own debts, and so on, leading to a domino effect type of collapse. These are all good questions to ask, and they suffer from very little public curiosity and debate, despite the tremendous impact they could have on all of us. The monetary wizards have to make sure that just the right amount of money is available for current and future levels of economic activity. Not too much more, and not too much less. If the wizards don't keep control of these things, then money can become meaningless and worthless, and that will surely affect us all, just like it did for everyone during the Great Depression, and just like it did recently for countries like Argentina, Mexico, Thailand, and Indonesia, to name a few. To answer the first part of this question, it is important to point out that the Federal Reserve has learned how to create the appropriate amount of money primarily based on simple trial and error. Some very big errors indeed. Through spectacular screw-ups like the 1930s Great Depression and the 1980s spike in interest rates, they have learnt what not to do. However, while past experience is a useful guide, it doesn't help you with knowing how to operate in a totally renovated financial system. As we'll see in future episodes of The Wizards of Money, the financial landscape has changed radically over the past few decades, with the proliferation of new debt instruments, the derivatives markets, unregulated entities like hedge funds, and a growing mound of consumer, government, and corporate debt. Do the central banks and the regulators really know how to keep things under control in this environment? On that note, let's answer the second part of the question about checks and balances on money creation by the banks. In order to make sure that commercial banks don't go crazy making too many loans and creating too much money for the economy, central banks like the Federal Reserve and several government regulators set limits on how much money banks can create or lend based on how much money bank shareholders have at risk in the bank. These limits are referred to as the risk-based capital rules, and we'll talk more about these in later episodes of The Wizards of Money. For now, we'll just note that exactly the same issue applies as for controls on the Federal Reserve, and that is, how do we know that these controls will work in the current financial environment with trillions of dollars controlled by unregulated entities like hedge funds and various derivative instruments, and the complexity of modern financial instruments such that only geeky math professors could possibly understand them?
Well, Congressman, remember that our central focus is on the overall economy. I mean, our mandate is to create maximum sustainable growth in the context of price stability. And it's clear all of the variables you just outlined have significant impacts on the pattern of both product prices and on economic output and employment. And to that extent, obviously, we watch them, we look at them, we evaluate them, and we try to integrate their effects into an overall view of the way the economy is functioning. But as far as policy is concerned, our ultimate objective is on how the economy is functioning overall, and we do not endeavor in any way to apply monetary policy towards altering any of the individual variables that you outlined.
I see. Thank you, Chairman Brainstrain.
That was Wizard Greenspan giving a summary of how the Federal Reserve makes its decisions. But notice one thing he never addresses. Is money democratic or not? Let's think about this. Is the public invited to participate in the deliberations of the commercial banks? I don't think so. Do you recall seeing the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meetings broadcast on C-SPAN? Nope. Do you remember presidential candidates discussing these issues in debates? No way. Of all the things that affect the quality of our lives, the mechanics of money is the one that stands out as escaping public scrutiny altogether. Interestingly, and despite concerns professed by founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson about the influence of the banking sector, the heart of the monetary system was intentionally designed to be free of public influence. It is certainly no accident that the process for appointing decision makers at the Federal Reserve is the least influenced by politics of all federal appointments. And you can interpret this how you want. Some may interpret this as a means of ensuring that the monetary system is always in the hands of a certain class of people. Yet others may interpret this as a means of ensuring stability in the monetary system for the good of all. These interpretations aside, what are the consequences of the general public having no input into decisions about money creation? It's only the bank managers and the Open Markets Committee of the Federal Reserve Board that decide how much money gets created and, most importantly, for what purpose money should be created. These decisions are closed to public input. Decisions on making new money will always be based on whether a borrower can repay and how much interest the borrower can bring in, which is what creates bank profits. This means that most money will be created to lend to people that already have previously created money and/or have certain advantages in life that will enable them to collect money in the future. Disadvantaged people will more likely be denied access to the money-creating process, and because they are at a disadvantage, are more likely to be exploited by unfair loan terms. In our society, access to capital and access to opportunity go hand in hand. The ideal of equal opportunity meets its toughest adversary in the money creation process. What this lack of public input also means is that there is no link between the money creation process and the things that might be most desired by society. In fact, money is often created for exactly the things that many people do not really want at all. This includes projects that involve excessive destruction of natural resources like logging, building dirty power plants, mining and so forth, because the bank realizes that such projects are likely to bring back the money that will pay off the loans. It is also interesting to note that money is generally not created directly for the purpose of providing public goods such as education and healthcare, for such services will not pay the bank back in a timely manner. Rather, these services depend on recycled money through the tax system. And hence, it is not surprising that we have reached a situation where monetary value and social value are somewhat inversely correlated. And by this I mean that a good or service with a high monetary value in the private property markets often has a low social value. Conversely, High social value goods and services generally return a low monetary value. This is illustrated in an example where public goods providers such as teachers and nurses are some of the lower paid workers, and yet currency trading is one of the most lucrative professions there is and has also become quite socially destructive. It is reasonable to expect that this situation would be largely reversed by taking social factors and public input into consideration at the point of money origination. But some would then argue that public input would destabilize the system and make us all worse off than the current closed monetary system. It would seem to be quite important to be concerned that the money origination process is not subject to democratic accountability. Many of the problems created by this could be remedied if the public had more input into decisions surrounding the origination of money, but, as already noted, it could also lead to more problems than are being solved. At the very least, the mechanics of money should be high on the list of topics for public debate. In addition, once you understand the process for creating money out of thin air, you begin to see that what banks and the Federal Reserve do may not be so difficult after all. In fact, people can, and are, creating their own monetary systems for their own communities, and we'll discuss these homemade monetary systems in future episodes of The Wizards of Money. A most interesting outcome of this money creation process is that, because all money is matched by a corresponding amount of debt, money is a zero-sum game. The more of a positive net money balance I have, the more of a negative balance someone else has. And I can put my positive balance to work earning more money while I either sit around and do nothing or go out and work for more money. Because it is a zero-sum game, if my balance is getting more positive, then someone else's must be getting more negative. Compounding this imbalance is the fact that it's easier to grow your balance if you're already in a positive balance position. But because of the way credit is priced and various social trends over the years, such as the decline of union power, it's harder for someone to turn a negative balance positive, either through exchanging labour for money or by borrowing to start a business. This discussion is, of course, simply a restatement of the ages-old criticism of capitalism, that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. This fact of increasing imbalance is a major reason for a system of taxation in a capitalist economy. In this context, taxation is a way to partially correct the monetary system's imbalance by transferring money from the richer back to the poorer. And there are other government-sponsored programs that also try and correct the imbalance, such as in the provision of loans for housing and education at reasonable rather than exploitative prices for credit. But as we'll see in future episodes of The Wizards of Money, some of these government programs consist of even more hocus-pocus than the monetary system itself, and/or they've been an absolute boon to the already well-to-do along Wall Street. It's sometimes not clear who these programs were designed to help the most. And often overlooked in the zero-sum game is that most interesting of government objectives: to ensure that the monetary system cannot fail. This translates into ensuring that the major section of the world banking sector, namely the large West of financial institutions, must not fail. This would actually be disastrous for everyone, just like in the Great Depression. To reduce the risk of banking system failure, which ultimately comes from a sudden loss of confidence in our faith-based monetary system, institutions such as the Federal Depository Insurance Corporation, the International Monetary Fund, and other taxpayer-funded institutions have evolved into mechanisms for preventing banking system collapse. Unfortunately, however, what these mechanisms often amount to is the transferring of the cost that could collapse the banking system to places outside of the banking system. So many of these costs end up being borne by those who have the least say in the financial system, such as the US taxpayers who funded the cleanup of the savings and loans crisis, and the peoples of Asian and Latin American countries who had to pay back sizable IMF loans in the 1980s and 90s. As we'll see in later episodes of The Wizards of Money, These so-called bailout mechanisms are one of the most dangerous aspects of the contemporary financial infrastructure, and they significantly distort free markets where, ideally, investors would have to take personal responsibility for the financial risk they assume. And while it is true that the monetary system is a zero-sum game, it is also true that what it gives rise to are more and more real and tangible assets, from homes to cars to appliances, clothes, electronics, and the list goes on and on, for the use of the humans. But there is an obvious way to even look at this as a zero-sum game, and that is in our relationship to the environment or the non-humans. The more natural resources we use for our own production and consumption, the less is available for non-human users who might be needing it. There is only a finite supply of fresh water, sunlight, and land, and only so much carbon you can stuff back into the air before things get really messed up. But there are still no controls on how much we can come to dominate all of these natural cycles. Unfortunately, the design of the current financial system tends to encourage more and more capitalization of these resources onto the human side of the balance sheet, potentially bankrupting the other. Future episodes of The Wizards of Money will examine changes already taking place and propose changes to the financial system to address these issues. And finally, in closing, what is surprising is that this knowledge about the dangers of our monetary system is ancient wisdom and has been recorded in the primary texts of the world's major religions. For example, the Old Testament of the Bible speaks of the sin of usury in the concept of Jubilee, the period of eradication of all debts. Most likely, this is from very similar realizations about money thousands of years ago. It is quite ironic that the Federal Reserve note bearing the statement, "In God we trust," is the symbol of the faith-based monetary system that so blatantly violates the key principles of this ancient wisdom, claiming to be God's word itself. And on that Federal Reserve note, that's all for The Wizards of Money Part 1. You can visit The Wizards of Money at wizardsofmoney.org to get the text and audio of all Wizards episodes and to get links to more information and to exercise your brain with the Money Mysteries game.